Well, we begin this second session of today with hymn 108. O God of Bethel, by whose hand thy people still are fed, who through this weary pilgrimage hast all the fathers led. Hymn 108. Today's title is Refuge with the God of Jacob, and the reading is Psalm 46, and the reader is Brother Frank Ardley of Worthing. Frank. One of the outstanding features of these old Hebrew songwriters, these psalmists, is that underlying all their music, the unalterable conviction that God is there and will not be moved, and that he is utterly dependable. Notwithstanding all the reverses, the hardships, the perplexities, there is this unswerving and unabated confidence in God. Now, this is the rock foundation upon which they base their words and their music and their faith. And in Psalm 46, the expression of this confidence, it seems to me, is most startling and most convicting. Just have a look again at those first three verses. God is our strength and our refuge, a very present help in time of trouble, in trouble. Therefore will not we fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, and though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. You see, it matters not that the earth may be moved, or the mountains may be lifted into the sea, or the great deep may boil, or that the land may quake and burst. It matters not, because in the midst of the turmoil there is one place that is tranquil. In the midst of the upheaval there is one place which is stable. In the midst of the faltering and flux there is one place which is unmovable. In the midst of the shaking there is one place which is utterly unshakable, and that one place is the city of God, and it is unmovable and it is utterly safe, because there in that city is the holy place, and in the holy place is the God of the elect. The mountains may topple and the heathen may rage and the nations may roar, and it matters not. God is in his holy place and he will be exalted. And so in verse 10 you'll notice, be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the heathen. I will be exalted in the earth. Men who know this are called upon to be still and to realize what their God is like. And this we have heard, as I say, most startlingly today in this Psalm 46. Now, will you please notice, brethren and sisters, that in this psalm, the confidence which I've just attempted to describe, notice how it's developed in the psalm, and notice particularly how sharply it is focused in one sentence, which occurs twice in the psalm, that is, in verse 7 and verse 11. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Or to be more accurate, Yahweh of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. And here we are touching something which is quite central to the God-governed life, about the God who governs. First of all, he is with us. And secondly, he is our refuge. Now, what we have to ponder is that twofold declaration today, because it epitomizes the spirit of this psalm. We've got to focus it sharply on that sentence. That sentence is the central fact of the psalm. Yahweh of hosts, the God of Jacob. Can I just detain you for a few minutes to have a word about the use of this word Yahweh. Because you know well enough, and because you were well taught in the Word of God, you will know that the name Yahweh is special and unique. It reveals the deity as self-existent and eternal. Other names which are revealed in the Bible are sometimes preceded by qualifying words, but never so with this word, Yahweh. As you know, the Hebrews never wrote this name fully. It was the incommunicable name. It stood lonely and majestic as the sign and symbol of the deepest and the most intimate and infinite things about their God. It was, to some extent, inexplicable. In some sense, incomprehensible. I'm careful to say in some sense, because you'll be reminding me afterwards that in some sense it was understandable. I know that. But there's something about it which nobody can perfectly explain. It gives expression to those things about God which are the profoundest things of all. His absoluteness, without beginning, without end, without the taking of counsel, without forethought. For there was neither tongue, nor wisdom, nor counsel before him, this Yahweh. But more, we've come to understand it also in this way, that it represents the revelation of God manifestation. Through the teaching of our brethren at first, in the days of Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts, and subsequently in all the brethren who have investigated it so well, we've come to understand that it reveals a God who is a continuous God. A God who will be continued, in a sense, in others. The becoming God. I am that I am. I will be whom I will be. A God becoming to others all that they need. Revealing the self-determining power of the Most High and marking his utter sufficiency for all the needs of men. Becoming to them all that they need in their sorrow, sadness, and in their utter predicament. So, we are in the presence of the greatest of all the words into which the fact of God has been compressed. Yahweh of hosts. Now, as we look at Psalm 46, we ought to notice that the psalmist came very near to qualifying this great name, but he said, as you'll notice, as I've just repeated, Yahweh of hosts. And I said it came very near to qualifying it, but it didn't really, I don't think, for the words of hosts are not a qualification of Yahweh. The truth is that, in a sense, Yahweh is seeming to qualify the word hosts, because they are the hosts of Yahweh. Now, what I want to interest you in next, therefore, is the word hosts. You know, it's used in the Bible in differing ways, and I want to interest you in how it's done. First of all, then, it is a word used and applied to stars. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 1, we read, "And the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them." And in the prophecy of Isaiah chapter 40, verse 26, "Lift up your eyes on high, and see who hath created these, that bringeth out their host by number. He calleth them all by name, by the greatness of his might, and for that he is strong in power, not one is lacking." So, hosts is applied to stars. The next, hosts is applied to angels. 1 Kings 22:19, "I saw the Lord sitting upon his throne, and all the host of heaven standing by him on his right hand and on his left." And in that song that was sounded over Bethlehem so long ago, measured by human measurement, when earth was waiting, spent and restless, Luke 2 verse 13, "There was a multitude of the heavenly host praising God." So hosts apply to angels. And then again, something else. In the book of Exodus, the word host is applied to the children of Israel. They are spoken of as the host of God. And in Genesis 32, we can read of the host of Esau. So, bringing these thoughts together, notice that the word is used of stars in the heavens, of angels, the ministers of God in heaven, beyond our vision and for most part outside our knowledge, and then of companies of people who march across the earth and dwell upon its surface. Stars and seraphim and saints. Hosts of stars, hosts of angels, hosts of men. Now with that in mind, come back to that phrase in Psalm 46, Yahweh of hosts, Lord of hosts. It is telling us, isn't it, that God is superior to all these forces which are compressed into the word hosts. He is master of all those forces. He is the Lord of the hosts, whatever they are. He is preeminent and absolutely far and above all these things. He is the Lord of all these things. He is sufficient and superior to these things in every way. He is the Lord of the heavens. He knows all the hosts of the heavens, and he marshals them at his will. But more, he is Lord of all the angelic hosts. In Psalm 103, you'll remember, bless the Lord, bless Yahweh, ye his angels that excel in strength, that do his commandments, hearkening unto the voice of his word. And then, he is the Lord of the world of men. He ruleth in the kingdoms of men, and setteth up whomsoever he will. Every hair of every man and woman is numbered. Not a sparrow falls to the ground without his knowledge. The universe of matter, the universe of spirit, the universe of mind, he controls and marshals them all in infinite wisdom and with unchallenged might. So in the phrase Yahweh of hosts, we are reminded of the absolute power and majesty and might and wisdom of the great God of heaven, Lord of the universe. In other words, we are given a vision of one side of the great Creator, the sustainer of life, here and everywhere. One side of his great majestic existence. But this is the thing to marvel at, brethren and sisters. In this short sentence in Psalm 46, quite suddenly, we are given another view of the same great God of heaven. Yahweh of hosts, and then quite suddenly, daringly, startlingly, the God of Jacob. You see, just think where we were a few moments ago. Think where we were. We were amid the great cosmic conception of the invisible Creator. We were amid the eternal expanse of his great realm. The angels who could blind us with their light and their glory, baffle us with their power. We were among the stellar spaces of the universe. And then quite suddenly, without warning, we move from that to this. The God of Jacob. And the stars grow dim, and the angel hosts fade, and suddenly we are on one small planet, in one small country, looking into the face of one lonely man, Jacob, the supplanter. And what we've got to understand is this. The psalmist is telling us for our salvation that the God who is Lord of the universe, the God who is Lord of all the heavenly hosts, cosmic and angelic, the creator of the stellar spaces, the creator of the angelic intelligences, that great God is also the God of that speck of humanity, that lonely man called Jacob. And just as positively as the great God is committed to that, and just as positively the great God is committed to that man as much as he is committed to all the order of his infinite universe. That's what we've got to learn from that sentence. See, as I often tell my comrades at Oxford, in the Bible every word is important. And it is no coincidence that the phrase is, Yahweh of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge. It's no coincidence that it's Jacob the supplanter. Jacob the heel catcher. See, I don't know what you in this audience, I don't know what you may think about Jacob. It's a very interesting thing. I go about listening to people talking and I find there are varying views about Jacob. Some people think he was a hard, mean man, self-sufficient and astute. Well, if you think he was, if that's what you think about Jacob, then I want to say that there was one man in the Bible who was harder and meaner and more self-sufficient. And that man was Laban. Of all the hard, astute, hard-driving, mean men, I would think Laban is number one. And I want to tell you something. Perhaps I oughtn't to say this. It gives me a great deal of satisfaction to realise that Jacob was one too many for Laban. Oh, it gives me a great... You see, whatever you may think about Jacob, whatever you may think about him, this is the thing to fix on now. Whatever he was, God cared for him, nurtured him, watched over him, kept his covenant with him, defeated him at Jabbok, and in the defeat made him to triumph, and renamed him with a wonderful name, as you know. He named him Israel, which means, as I've told you before, God mastered, which means God governed. And if you want to challenge it, you can, but you'll find it's true. That's the mystery. The God of Jacob. All through the years, you see, in spite of the deception, notwithstanding whatever he did, yes, in spite of his weakness, in spite of his self-assurance, never mind, God enwrapped him with his care, told him where to rest his head, gave him a vision of covenanted love at Bethel. And when this Jacob was filled with fear as he left Paran to meet his brother Esau, full of foreboding over what Esau would be feeling perhaps after 40 years from the time of the deception, brooding about the way in which he had been deceived and supplanted, at last God made Esau's anger, which Jacob feared, he made it to be turned into love, and instead of wrath, the brothers greeted each other with a kiss. This is the revelation then. Yahweh of hosts, infinite in majesty, stupendous in power, the God of Jacob, infinite in mercy. Yahweh of hosts, as I say, stupendous in power, upholding all things by his commanding word. And then the God of Jacob, sublime in his pity. And here is the wonder of it. When you think of the stellar spaces, when you think of the light years, the galaxies, when you think of the myriads of angels, the cherubim and the seraphim, Yahweh of hosts, of necessity, it's wonderful, but it's so far away. It's outside our experience so much. It's wonderful, but it's beyond us. The eternal order amid the stars and amid the angels, it's wonderful, but it's awful and it's distant. So far away, just a glimpse of his glory on a starry night. Just that. It seems so far away. Now this
this psalm is telling us that we are wrong. In our seeming, we are wrong. He is not far away. The psalmist is saying he is with Jacob, this infinite God of the stellar spaces. He is with Jacob, and because he is with Jacob, he is with you. So it's not only in the immensity of the world that the great God is revealed, it's in the infinity of smallness sometimes that he is revealed as well. He is not far away. Notwithstanding the failure, notwithstanding the inconstancy, despite the great gulf between what God intended and what man has done, in spite of the fact that life has been blighted and humanity has been ravaged by the dwarfing influences of sin and man's selfishness, never mind, notwithstanding, these are the words, the God of Jacob. This Yahweh, he's created man and made him for one purpose only, to give glory to his creator. And the creature has brought shame and degradation into the world and broken all the holy laws which God has given and ravaged his purpose. But still he is the God of Jacob. Still he broods over him tenderly and carefully and tirelessly and lovingly, his folly notwithstanding. So this is what we ought to think about. With all this upon our hearts, we ought to come back to Psalm 46 and look at it again. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Now let's notice, please, what it means then in the light of this little exposition so far. Yahweh of hosts is with us, the God of the stars, that is, the God of the angels, the God of men in multitude, is with us. He is with us for the making of Jacob, and therefore for the making of all of us who share Jacob's faith. And here's the wonderful thing, and this is what I want to propose to you now. You may think it's outrageous, but never mind. I'm proposing to you what we ought to understand from this. He is concerned with the making of Jacob and therefore with the making of you. And this is the thing. He will press all these hosts, over whom, over which he reigns, he will press them into that service for that purpose if it be necessary. I believe that's what this psalm means. The God who controls these hosts will control them for your sake, for Jacob's sake, because he is our refuge. Now you may think that's a very far-fetched idea, but look, I am not here to speculate. I'm only here to try to unravel what this Bible is teaching us. So I put it to you. Could it mean that God would use the stars then? Would he use the stars for the making and remaking of those who are destined for high purpose in the great plan of redemption? Well, now, I'm going to recollect for you something written in the Song of Deborah, the Bible's angry young woman. I bring you to Judges chapter 5. Judges chapter 5, the Song of Deborah, verses 17 to 23. I'm reading from the AV. Judges 5 verse 17, Gilead abode beyond Jordan. And why did Dan remain in ships? Asher continued on the seashore and abode in his breeches. Zebulun and Naphtali were a people that jeoparded their lives unto the death in the high places of the field. The kings came and fought. Then fought the kings of Canaan at Taanach, the waters of Megiddo. They took no gain of money. They fought from heaven. The stars in their courses fought against Sisera. The river Kishon swept them away, the ancient river, the river Kishon. O my soul, thou hast trodden down strength. Then were the horses' hoofs broken by the means of prancing, the prancings of their mighty ones. Kirshi Meraz, said the angel of the Lord, Kirshi bitterly, the inhabitants thereof, because they came not to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the mighty. Now, you'll notice in this song, Deborah deplores the fact that there were some who did nothing to advance the cause of God and God's people. Dan remained in his ships, Asher sat still, others arrested themselves by the watercourses of Reuben, ruminating and talking and doing nothing. But notwithstanding, there were forces in heaven which fought for the chosen people of the Lord. What were the forces? The stars. The stars in their courses fought against Sisera. Of course, you're all wanting to know, what on earth does it mean? The stars in their courses fought against Sisera. How did it happen? Well, I'm going to make a suggestion. Nothing more than a suggestion. Possibly this. That just as the river Nile floods when Sirius the dog star rises, so perhaps the river Kishon flooded by the influence of the stars. Now, this is what happened. In fact, there is no doubt. Verse 21, the river Kishon swept them away. They were swept away by the flooded river Kishon. And you know, it's so much a reality, so much a wonderful fact, that you'll notice Deborah, as it were, stops the telling of the narrative in order to be exhorted by the wonder of the facts. Verse 21, onto the Revised Version here, just a second. Oh my soul, march on with strength. That's what it is in the Revised Version. Deborah is so moved by the realization and recollection of what happened, the wonder of it. Oh my soul, march on with strength. So, the Lord has at once commanded the stars and used them in the course of his great purpose. And all I ask this audience is this simply: is there anybody in this house who dare say he'll never do it again? Because if there is, let them stand up. There's not one of us dare say that he cannot do it again. Because think of this: once he counted the life of the Lord of the stars worth giving for the sake of saving broken humanity. Once the balances were held up and the voice said, what doth it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his life? And if he will give the one for whom the stars have been created and the one in whom the very stars consist, if he will give him for the sake of saving man, he surely would not hesitate to use the stars in that purpose if they were needed. I leave you to ponder it. Now, need I argue it in the case of angels? Will he use the angels? Well, if I try to argue it strongly, I'd be insulting your intelligence, wouldn't I? The angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him. Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to do service for the sake of them that shall inherit salvation? See that ye despise not one of these little ones that believe in me, for I tell you that their angels do forever behold the face of my Father which is in heaven. And what is this great word that once fell from the lips of the king himself? Thinkest thou not that I cannot beseech my Father, and he will even now give me more than 12 legions of angels? Remember once, God, responding to the word of Elijah the prophet, opened the eyes of that fearful man who was with him. And the man saw the mountain full of angels and flaming with angel light. I needn't argue it, need I? It's too evident. And what about the hosts of men? Will he use them in the course of his great purpose to save you? Well, he is Lord of all the hosts of men, of that there is no doubt. He is Lord of all the armies in the world. If men will fight, and they will, then you can be sure he is the God of battles. He is El Gibor, the God of battles. That means he ruleth in the kingdoms of men, he setteth up whomsoever he will, and when men make war, he governs their goings. No army ever marches across the face of the earth but in the control of his strong hand. Now, this is the truth. He will compel the march of men to the making of his own men and in the fulfilling of his great purpose. Think of Ezekiel 38. The armies of Gog, how are they moving? By their own volition altogether? I will put hooks in thy jaws, said the voice. He is Lord of all. Lord of the physicist, Lord of the architect, Lord of the scientist. In a way, they discover what he is disposed to reveal at the time he wills. I have a feeling, you see, that every discovery of man, in a way, is a revelation from God. You see, it's no coincidence, as it appears to me, that when in the purpose of God the time came for the great spiritual reformation in Europe, which would result in the unveiling of the truth in the latter days, when that time came, what did men discover? They discovered printing. And it's no coincidence, I think, that as the world moves to its final hour of agony, men have discovered nuclear fission. See, Carlyle, you remember Carlyle? At your school days? Well, Carlyle once said, God may be in his heaven, but he does nothing. Of course, Carlyle was wrong. God is in his heaven, and he's always doing something. He is the Lord of hosts. He will press into the service of making Jacob into Israel, the hosts of stars, the hosts of angels, and the hosts of men. Of that, I think you can be sure. The psalmist says, the Lord of hosts is with us, and the God of Jacob is our refuge. Now what we've got to examine finally is, what then does it mean, the God of Jacob is our refuge? Well, obviously, the only way to measure that sentence is to try and discover in what way he was a refuge to Jacob. Let's recollect how patiently and how painstakingly God worked upon Jacob. Just think what he did to recover this lonely man for himself. He opened the heavens and he fixed the ladder. And on the ladder, the ascending and the descending angels. Then one day he gave him a vision of hosts. Jacob called the place Mahanaim, which means the place of two hosts. And Jacob said, I think it's in the first verse of Genesis 32, with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two companies. It's a strange phrase, isn't it? With my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two companies. Now I understand that to mean that Jacob was rejoicing in the way his possessions had multiplied since he first crossed Jordan. That's what he's saying. He sort of doubled his possessions since his first crossing of Jordan. And he had to learn that none of his possessions were really his own, that the Lord of hosts is Lord also over Jacob's possessions. He's the Lord of Jacob's hosts. And he possesses every last skin of cattle and every last shekel. This God, the Lord of hosts. And then, of course, as I've already hinted, There were the hosts of Esau. Esau is coming, it says, and it's interesting. It says he is coming with a host of armed men to meet his brother Jacob. And then Jacob met God at Jabbok, at Peniel, and he was crippled, as we know. A strange night of wrestling with a man of God, and as a result he was crippled, and he was never the same again. He was crippled, and he was a limping man. He became him that halteth. But the mystery is that in the crippling he was made whole. In the breaking he was healed. You remember Genesis 32, it is, you'll remember Jacob said to the man of God, I will not let you go except you bless me. Now, of course, brothers and sisters, if only we knew how he said it, we should know a great deal about Jacob and about this whole situation, this mysterious situation. If only we knew the tone of voice. Do you think he said it stridently? He was a strong man. Did he say it strongly, demandingly, like it sounds? I will not let you go unless you bless me. Wonder how he said it. Wrestling Jacob, the tone of voice. It's important, the tone of voice, you know. It makes a world of difference. The tone in which you say a thing makes a world of difference. There are two ways of saying, I love you. One's better than the other. Yes, if only we knew. Well, here's a strange thing, a wonderful thing. Hundreds of years afterwards, a prophet talking about something quite different let slip the tone of Jacob's voice. I bring you to Hosea chapter 12. Hosea chapter 12, AV. I want you to follow this with me, so I'm waiting till you're ready. Alright? Hosea chapter 12. Ephraim feedeth on wind and followeth after the east wind. He daily increaseth lies and desolation. And they do make a covenant with the Assyrians. And oil is carried into Egypt. The Lord hath also a controversy with Jacob, and will punish Jacob according to his ways. According to his doings will he recompense him. He took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God. Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept. He had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spake with us. There is the revelation, what we were wondering. It was there all the time, you see. So it wasn't spoken stridently at all. It was a voice choked with tears. It was the last sob of a defeated man. He is going down in the last agony of despair beneath the pressure of the mysterious man of God. And this is the mystery, as I say. He triumphed in the moment in which he was beaten. He was remade when he was broken. He was made whole when he was crippled. See, a man cannot defeat God. Nobody defeats God. A man comes to victory with God when God defeats him. That's the truth of it. When a man yields to God, he wins. It's the absolute opposite of the principle of normal life. That's why his name is Israel. It tells of his new status. As I said, Israel means God mastered. Not mastering God, God mastering him. Now you may want to tell me, and I respect you for it, you may want to tell me that Israel means prince with God. But it means that only inferentially. in the sense that a man has power with God when that man is defeated by God. Then he becomes a prince. A man is exalted to be a prince when he is humbled and submits. This is the great principle of the New Testament. And this is what Jacob experienced. This is what happened to him. So, I can imagine, you can imagine, as he limps up from the brook at Jabbok to his friends who have been waiting all night on the other side, wondering what on earth has happened to Jacob. He limps up to them and he tells them he is no more Jacob the supplanter. He is Israel, God governed, mastered by God so that he may have power with God. So this is what happened to him, and I suppose somewhere in this experience, and of course the things that happened thereafter, somewhere in this experience, brethren and sisters, is the idea of refuge. The God of Jacob is our refuge. And he inferences that not only is he our refuge, but he was refuge for Jacob as well. Now I believe that there are people in this house today who, because of their experience, they understand it. People perhaps who are going grey as I am going grey. People upon whom God has put his hand and they have been wounded, and they've discovered that in the very wounding they have found healing. Crippled perhaps they've been, and mysteriously in the very crippling they have been made strong for more service. It's mysterious, isn't it? Cherished dreams perhaps have been shattered, but in such a way that the visions of deeper things have been realized and followed. And it may be, they would say to us, if we cared to interrogate them, they would say that they know they will never be the same again. They will go softly all their days. But ask them if they would be different. Ask them if they would have been without it. Ask them if in the passing through Peniel they would have wished to have retraced their steps and missed it. And they will tell you they wouldn't be without it. The God of Jacob is their refuge. The Lord of hosts is marshalling the forces to remake them who are broken. This word refuge is an interesting word, of course. I believe its first meaning is the high place. The refuge is the high place. In the Proverbs, you could read this. Proverbs 18 verse 10, the name of Yahweh is a strong tower, the righteous runneth into it and are safe. The idea of refuge in the tower. In the high place, men can be set, as it were, above the circumstances, above the forces which hurt and harm, above the enemies, above self. They can rise above these things which hinder and impede and fetter and degrade, and therefore they look to the future with confidence from the high place, from the refuge and the security, because the Lord of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge. And so, because we are assembled this week under the theme of consider your ways, we're compelled therefore to ask this question: how, if you can believe this, if you can put your faith in this, how will it affect us, this assurance? What will be, or what could be, or what should be the result of this realization upon our daily lives, the daily manifestation of the God-governed life? What should it do about the God-governed life in our experience? Well, I propose to you that it ought to be seen in the quiet calm of
our spirit, in the tenderness of our compassion, in the straightness of our dealings, and in the developing faithfulness of our living. And I believe, brethren and sisters, as you ponder it, and as you seek to make it incarnate in your lives, and as you seek to appropriate it according to your faith, it will happen in proportion to your yielding to the word which is written, which is a light in a dark world. It will happen in proportion to the will which is known and understood, the will of God, to the service which is discovered in the needs of God's people. And so we may know that Yahweh of hosts is with us, that is, the Lord of order and precision, the Lord of power, and the God of Jacob, that is, the God of love and care and sympathy. The Lord of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge. And I propose to you that it is this which is at the very centre of the God-governed life. May God grant you all to realise it and feel it to be true in the oncoming days.